The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher, go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily political podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Kangasorium of Focal Data and Kate Andrews. Now, we're going to be talking about the US election results, what else, a day on chewing through rotten men, and talking about what James has told me is his new go-to phrase, asymmetric realignment. Kate, just briefly, can you bring listeners up to speed with where the results look now?
Not only has Donald Trump won, he really has won in a landslide. While Arizona and Nevada still haven't been formally called, they clearly are leaning towards Donald Trump, and it looks like he's going to win all seven swing states. There is pretty much no doubt now that he has secured the popular vote. He's about 4.5 million votes ahead of Harris, and both of them are ticking up, obviously, as the results continue to come in. And whilst we won't have this confirmed for several more days, it looks like the Republicans have not just won the Senate, they have very likely also won the House, which should give Donald Trump 2 years of actually being able to do things in the Oval Office. There's no doubt that he has a mandate, but what he actually plans to prioritize and get over the line remains to be seen. And it's great that we've got James here, because I just think there's so many outstanding questions about how what was considered to be 50-50 up until the polls closed ended up being such a landslide. I think there are big questions about which topics actually resonated with voters. It's clear the economy did. It's clear abortion, while it mattered, did not matter nearly as much as people thought it would. And the fact that Harris underperformed with practically every group.
Now, James, just to start you off with a light question, as someone who runs polls and is a pollster, as well as many other things, why did the pollsters get it wrong? Or do you think that they did not?
Broadly, look, I think there was a polling error this election. I think that needs to be quite clear. But I think the other thing that's critical is that the story that was told from the polls was also equally incorrect this time. So I'll kind of dig into both of those. So if you looked at the numbers, there were a number of different pollsters who suggested that actually Trump was headed for a kind of small win in the swing states, actually, but a big win everywhere else. It's a very paradoxical win, actually. And those pollsters, I think Atlas was one of them. I think our own James Johnson, JL Partners, was also quite clear. He also forecast a popular vote lead. So there were actually quite a large clutch of firms that actually did suggest that. There were also a large clutch of firms that said it was very, very close. In the end, the polls were marginally wrong in the swing states, potentially less wrong, by the way, than in 2020 and 2016. But here's the really interesting thing. The polls, or the suggested kind of implied vote lead for Trump in the country, and actually in the uncompetitive states, that's really where they were really wrong. So it's kind of in the kind of New Hampshire, the kind of close vote that was there, the Connecticut, the vote there was closer than I think anticipated, Virginia, New Mexico. If you look at all the kind of Democrat states that maybe would have been marginal 20 years ago, but have since become safely Democratic, actually they were far closer to the marginal line. And I think it's in those kind of areas, in California, New York, do we really think there would be, like, I think, what was it, a 10-point gap in New York? I think what's really interesting there is just quite how the dynamics of the election, I think, were slightly different to what was anticipated. And for me, I think at the source of it, the post-mortem is going to take a long time, but it is interesting that there's attention again on the polls underestimating, marginally this time, Donald Trump's vote, but it's the same direction. I think that's what's really unique. I don't think we've had in many democratic systems polling errors that have been correlated election to election. And I think that's the thing, because each time a whole industry is making fixes for the same thing. And then for it to reappear implies that something's systematically wrong. And across the world, in general, it's harder to survey right-wing parties and right-wing voters. I mean, we saw that in the UK general election. Yes, the big story there was Labour not at 43%, but at 34%. But actually, the Conservative vote being at 23.7 was actually a bit higher than people thought.
Why do you think that is? Because right-wing voters don't want to be judged when they're asked what they're going to say, or prejudice, or is it something else when they're harder to reach?
Yeah, well, this is proper retail stuff, but I think it's primarily to do with a very catchy term called non-response bias.
Another catchy term. Another,
which I did not
today.
Invent. It's been around for a long time. But basically, it's this idea that Republicans don't really want to give their views or take surveys. And it's interesting that Republican-leaning polling firms have had a better job at gaining access to this. I think it's also potentially to do with certain SKUs and online panels, which provide the majority of data that goes into polls. And some of the companies employing mixed methodologies have not quite got there. But again, this is the kind of thing that is going to be studied for another year. But we are going to, you know, this is now 12 years in the US where we've had the same polling errors in the same directions. I think what was clear this time is that people were prepared for a marginal polling error. People said this was a close election. And the reality is, actually, if a few hundred thousand votes had been different in the swing states, even though Donald Trump won the popular vote, it could, you know, his vote is now a lot less efficient. It's quite interesting. Things could have been different, but this was a big defeat. And I think the story that people told wasn't correct. So when people say this was a close election, that does not imply that the result will be close. That is like a misunderstanding of polling. If you think every single swing state is very close to being marginal between the two parties, if someone is 1% higher than you'd expect it, that means that we're all of them move in one direction. And I think the people who are a bit more circumspect about how they were putting out their information would say this. They would say, this is a close election, but it is completely conceivable that Donald Trump or Kamala Harris could come out with 300 votes. And I think a lot of the British pollsters actually were quite good at this. I think that was a very common refrain that we heard from British pollsters commenting on the election in the US. I'm not sure it was the story in the US.
And Kate, just before we tune to some of those voter groups, we, better late than never, took a while, had Kamala Harris's speech yesterday, last night in UK time, conceding, talking about the number of stars in the sky. Can you just fill listeners in on the message from her? And also, what is the post-mortem looking at the moment within the Democrat camp? Is there a sense that, wait, this candidate, perhaps all the concerns we had about them when they were previously written off were correct and we just denied them because it was awkward and the situation with Joe Biden? Or is there a feeling things went wrong in the campaign?
Kamala Harris came out and she conceded. She made very clear that she congratulated President-elect Trump on his win. But she also made incredibly clear how disappointed, frustrated, and unaccepting of the ideas behind the result she was. So she completely accepts the result, but the message was, we do not stop fighting because we do not accept the path, the trajectory that the country was now on. It was not a terribly gracious speech. Frankly, it's the kind of speech I think Donald Trump should have given 4 years ago when he lost in 2020, and that is not a compliment, right? The fact that he didn't come out and concede was frankly unforgivable, but it was not gracious. It was not kind. And it's the kind of attitude. And, you know, there was really a sense of just being a little bit grossed out by the result. Perhaps maybe that's what we would have expected or could have expected of Donald Trump. I'm going to call it a low bar. And we had some, you know, classic Harris moments talking about how when it's darkest, that's when you see the stars, the kind of things that you put on a poster in a 12-year-old's bedroom. It was really borderline word salad-y. There were a lot of classic Harris buzzwords, not quite as good as James's asymmetric realignment, but, you know, security, faith, hope, things that are nice things, don't get me wrong, but usually need more context in the situation. Look, I wasn't, a lot of people I don't think would have been terribly inspired by it, but I was not a gung-ho Harris supporter. And that ended up being her problem in this election. Actually, it was women like me. The white female vote did not come out for Harris. Trump won it clearly. He won the majority. I think a lot was taken for granted by the Democrats in this election. And to your point, Katie, are they going to recognize this and are they going to change tact? we can only hope, really, because every country needs a functioning opposition. I don't think the Democrats had one the past 4 years with Donald Trump and all the messiness and, frankly, a lot of the narcissism that went along with keeping MAGA alive. I hope the Democrats make a different choice. The early signs are negative. There is a lot of talk about how the only explanation about why Harris lost is because she is a Black woman. There is a lot of talk about how she ran a perfect campaign. We've heard it's a flawless campaign. Former President Barack Obama talked about her remarkable campaign in his and his wife's statement. And you just sit there and you think to yourself, Mr. President, you ran two truly spectacular campaigns. You know what a good campaign looks like. Surely you really don't think this was one of them. There's a refusal at the moment to really grapple with what's happened. It has, of course, only been a couple of hours. So they've got years to sort this out. And it is just incredibly clear that the attempt in this campaign to divide women and men, and Trump did it too, I'm not saying it's just the Democrats, but the attempt to appeal to women and really not to men, the expectation that minority voters would turn out, it was a huge mistake. It was a huge mistake, especially when they were kind of pretending to have a message of unity, and none of that was beneath the surface.
And James, as you say, the postmortem is going to take a long time, but initially looking at those results and looking at the different groups. Kate talks about this idea of the gender wars, but it didn't really look like that, particularly amongst certain demographics.
Yeah. So I think there are three big themes that come out from the election. The first is the Democrats made a bet on basically losing a group of voters, which were not losing in aggregate, but having a swing against them, in particular young Black men, Hispanic men, but also on certain low propensity voters. And then in the hope of basically gaining white college-educated people, and in particular, white college-educated women. I used the catchy term asymmetric realignment, but basically I think...
It's the zeitgeist of this podcast.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Should we just say it one more time?
No, let's
not. For the cheap seats in the back?
Yeah, let's not.
So we sound like we're being... It's just that James told us it was his catchy new phrase just before we started recording.
Made up 5 minutes before, but okay. but sure, I'll put it on a t-shirt for you. Basically, she was correct in forecasting that there would be a degree of race depolarization, and that people would vote less along ethnic lines and race lines and more along education and income lines, except she lost the votes on that basis, but it's not like she then gained the required votes. And that's what's asymmetric about it. So that's the first theme. And the second theme related to it is this kind of identity paradox, right? Which is the Democrats talk a lot about who's voting for whom based on what racial or ethnic or gender characteristic. But the voters they've lost are precisely those people for whom economics, the cost of living, other issues are more important in terms of who they are, their values, what they think needs fixing. And it's incidental that they have these markers. So it's really interesting if you hear kind of Democrat conversations, there's a lot of angst that they are basically, you know, the Republican Party is moving towards becoming a more working class, multiracial party. It's a point of extreme discomfort to a party that sees itself as the party of the poor and organized labor and ethnic minorities. Those are literally the same groups that are leaving the party, right? Which creates a kind of meta sense of inauthenticity. But the point is those people are leaving precisely because they don't want to be defined by those markers. So there is a fundamental identity paradox question that needs to be answered in American politics. The third is that basically from the election, it's very clear that the fundamentals were the things that mattered, which is incumbent governments are getting chucked out of everywhere and they're no different. Two, related to the incumbency problem, the inflationary pressure built up from COVID is hurting governments everywhere. It was the top issue all through the year, and Donald Trump was seen as better on the economy, better on inflation, but also better on immigration as well, which was always featuring in the top three issues. And that's the thing. Like, Americans took a look around, thought that uncontrolled migration wasn't a good thing, took a look around and thought that brat summer and memes was not the best reply to working class people not being able to afford groceries. And I think this is the result.
Yeah, okay, I was struck, this is an uninformed point, just by the sheer number of celebrities always with Kamala Harris near the end of the campaign. Every time I went on my Instagram, I just saw, perhaps this says more about who I follow, but it was people I didn't follow were popping up in my feed explaining why people had to vote Kamala Harris. And in the UK, and I'm interested in the American view on this, as soon as you get a celebrity involved, it's almost as though they immediately get vitriol from the UK press and figures saying, why is this celebrity daring to speak about politics? You know, they are so out of touch. And I wonder if it was a cultural thing, but clearly it did not seem to be working in the way she thought it would.
I think as soon as you saw all these celebrities come out for Kamala Harris, that was maybe the first major indication that things were not going to go her way. Because to your point, Katie, Americans are going the way of the UK on this. Maybe 25, 30 years ago, a particular celebrity endorsement could have been helpful, but that would also help get you media, right? And it would help boost your brand, and it would help boost the extent to which people were seeing you in the public eye. I think in the age of social media, this is just completely out the window. I mean, the podcasters that Harris and Trump sat down with are celebrities in their own right. But the idea that you actually have to talk, you have to give policy, you have to give your ideas, you have to show someone who you are, is embedded into those podcasts.
And you're reaching an audience through those.
Right.
You know,
that are
in some cases, a huge audience.
Right. Yeah. And also, you're reaching an audience in a completely different way. You're saying, I would like you to hear what I have to say, rather than the simple badge of celebrity means that I am now elevated and you have to listen to what I say. It's a completely different way of approaching your audience. And again, Harris just wasn't telling us as much as Donald Trump was. Now, a lot of people will hate what he's saying and be worried about what he's saying, but you have a much better idea of what he thinks there. I also think in terms of the polls, it was really hard for pollsters to figure out the candidate that people would never vote for. And I think for a lot of people in this election, that was the case. You will still meet plenty of people who now are more inclined to admit they voted for Donald Trump, but not with any love.
Well, for me, the most interesting polling fact was the number of people who didn't like Donald Trump, who then voted for him. Harris didn't have that same cohort of people. If you didn't like Harris, it's not that you just didn't like her. You didn't like her values, but you didn't like what she was going to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas there clearly exists a group of contingent Republican voters who are like, look, we know that Donald Trump is problematic for a whole host of reasons, but we're still going to vote for him. And I think a lot of politics, right, is about who is the least popular. It's not about who's the most popular. Again, another catchy term, negative cohesion, which is basically pulling together groups of people based on who you don't like. And I think the Democrats don't quite understand that the progressive, hyper-progressive left is less popular and more threatening to more Americans than the Trumpian right. In their head, of course, this is a battle against good and evil. And I don't think they really understand that. They are further away from the median voter than those guys.
And there's one other aspect to the polling, which I just think would have been impossible to pick up, and it worked against the Democrats. The number of votes that were expected to come through for Harris because you don't like Donald Trump. And truthfully, this is the third election where right-leaning or swing voters have been asked to cast a vote, not because they're hopeful or excited about the Democratic candidate, but because they're not Trump. That was a big part of Hillary Clinton's message in 2016. That was pretty much the platform in 2020. And it also was the platform in 2024. And you could forgive your right-leaning or centrist voter for thinking, gosh, they keep making me vote for people that I don't really like and I certainly don't agree with on plenty of issues. And it still doesn't seem to be moving politics on. Donald Trump's back for a third time. And then they maybe go to those policies. They start to look at them. And they decide, I'm not going to like either of you, so I'm going to cast my vote based on the economy or inflation or the top issues that voters have been telling politicians they care about for 4 years, right? The number one issue in America has been the economy for 4 years. That hasn't shifted. And, you know, how are pollsters supposed to pick up on that or change it? A pretty convincing argument about a week ago was that the polls were underestimating Harris. To James's point, they've made all the corrections for Donald Trump, so now maybe it's Harris who's underestimated. No, it's just impossible to put some of these really important factors in this election into a question that's going to get answered in a way that gives us this landslide result.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.